This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Jesse Baring returns to point out the sexual deviant in us all in his book Perv, and then writer Nikki Hodgson recommends Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita. Before we start today's show, here's a message from our sponsor. If you like the sound of Jesse Baring's Perv or Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, but you'd prefer to consume them in talkie book format, both of those books are available on audible.co.uk. Little Atoms has teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer you a free audiobook of your choosing. All you have to do is to register for a 1 month free trial and you can claim your free audiobook, and there are over 80,000 to choose from. You can register at www.audible.co.uk/littleatoms, and that's a slash or a forward slash, but definitely not a backslash, thanks to everybody who took the time to point that out to me. The 30-day trial means that you can choose a free audiobook, which is yours to keep, whether or not you decide to cancel in the trial period. So remember, that's audible.co.uk/littleatoms, and the Little Atoms bit is all one word, and if you use that, I get some cash. So thank you. Jesse Baring is a frequent contributor to Scientific American and Slate. His writing has also appeared in New York Magazine, The Guardian and The New Republic, among other publications, and has been featured by NPR, Playboy Radio, the BBC and more. He's the author of The God Instinct and Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? He was formerly the director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Queen's University Belfast, beginning his career as a professor at the University of Arkansas. He's now the Associate Professor of Science Communication at the Centre for Science Communication at the University of Otago in Dunedin in New Zealand. Jesse's latest book is Perv, the Sexual Deviant in All of Us. So Jesse, first of all, thanks for coming back on Little Atoms. It's great to speak to you again.
It's a pleasure, Neil.
So we're going to talk about Perv, yes, and lots of things beside. And straight at the top, I can say that in the context of the last conversation that we had, you and I are absolutely, definitely perverts, aren't we? Because once upon a time, it had a different meaning.
That's right. Yeah. So my first book was about religion and essentially God being a cognitive illusion. And I came to the conclusion, or at least my theoretical argument in that book, was that God is really sort of a figment of the imagination. Is probably a bit too strong, but it's the product of hundreds of thousands of years of psychological evolution in the human species. And God does not exist outside of the human mind. And I think you were sympathetic to that. You're an atheist as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, we would be considered perverts in the sense of the term's original use, because the word pervert for the first 100 years of, actually several hundred years of its existence, had nothing at all to do with sexuality or sexual deviance. It was a term that referred to atheists, really. If you were a pervert, you were an atheist. You went against biblical prescription. You were doing something that was explicitly prescribed by the Bible.
So when did that begin to change then? Let's talk about when did the common use, the current use, first come into being?
It became a sexualized term, and almost uniquely a sexual term, in the late 19th century, when British sexologists actually began using the word pervert to refer to homosexuals mostly, because they were, basically, they understood society's reactions to same-sex romantic relationships as being inherently sort of a Bible-based fury, or somehow, you know, people being concerned about it because they went against what is right according to biblical scripture. So they were using the word pervert to refer to homosexuals to capture that idea, sort of the common usage of the word. And unfortunately, the word pervert stuck to gays and lesbians, you know, at least until the 1980s, when some psychoanalysts were still using the word pervert to refer to gay men. Especially, and the original sense of it, you know, referring to an atheist, has completely evaporated at this point. You don't hear the word pervert being used to describe atheists at all anymore, even though they're not mutually exclusive. You can be both gay and an atheist, like I am. But for the most part, today, the word pervert is used for somebody who is sexually deviant.
Why did you decide to write this book now? Why do you think it's a good time?
Well, two answers to that question, I suppose. I mean, I've always been interested in human sexuality because, you know, growing up gay in middle America during the 1980s, during the AIDS epidemic, I certainly dealt with a lot of my own issues concerning being a gay male, being homosexual. You know, there was a very vitriolic period, I think, in U.S. history at that point with the AIDS epidemic and a lot of rancor and unrest surrounding gay men, especially as being sort of the source of HIV and the gay plague, which, of course, we know today isn't true. But there was clearly an overrepresentation in the gay male community with HIV. And I simply thought at that point when I was 8 or 9 years old, that anybody who was attracted to the same sex was going to get AIDS. I didn't understand the sexual component of it. I didn't understand epidemiology, that you had to have unprotected sex to acquire the HIV virus. I just thought that if you were gay or if you liked the same sex, God was somehow going to punish you by giving you AIDS. And that was the source of a lot of anxiety for me and a lot of shame and guilt and fear. So I kept my homosexuality secret. I was closeted until I was in my early 20s. It was a very significant psychological issue, I suppose, this feeling of other people believing that I was perverted because something I had no control over growing up. But the other reason was simply because I had been writing quite a lot for Scientific American and other magazines about human sexuality. I take an evolutionary perspective in much of my writing. So inevitably, when you're talking about human evolution, you talk quite a bit about sex oftentimes. And I noticed that columns that I would write about sex, and especially sexually deviant orientations, got a lot of conversation going. So I saw that this was an area that was sort of ripe for exploration from an expository perspective, from a philosophical perspective. I think a lot of academics even had shied away from many of the topics that I talk about in PERV. And, you know, one thing led to another, and I wrote the book.
We've mentioned the idea that pervert, the word, used to mean atheist. It used to be somebody that, you know, perverted the true course of biblical teaching. Subsequently came to mean sexual deviance, but still in that sort of context. But now it's obviously a contentious word. You used it as the title of this book in obviously a slightly provocative way. So what does it, in the context of this book then, what are you looking at? What does pervert mean? What does perv mean in this way?
Well, yeah, I suppose, you know, one of the reasons that I went with the word perv was to really sort of push those buttons. I wanted to get to the bottom of why this is such a powerful, potent word to begin with. You know, why do we feel such strong emotions when somebody calls us a pervert or a perv or somebody else is called a perv? You know, why is that such a damaging slur to another individual if they have some sexually deviant orientation pattern? And I think when we explore it deeply, I think we run into all sorts of hypocrisies and problems, ultimately some transparencies about our own tendencies or arousal responses by the sheer emotion that we place in a word like pervert, you know, why it really is so strong and why we care so much about it. So using the word perv as the title of the book was, you know, it's more or less an experiment for me. It was a social experiment to see, you know, just how far I could go in terms of unsettling people with this accusation, essentially, that they have some sort of, that everybody has a sexually deviant erotic profile if you look at the right angle.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at that then, because you start off the book looking at how ways in which, yeah, human sexuality itself, in all of these terms we're going to be using through this, we'll just have to keep setting them out as being contentious because, you know, I'm going to get complaints otherwise. But I'll use normal as in, you know, statistically. You look at how various ways, just the very concept of human sexuality itself is in some way has many oddities and weirdnesses to it.
Yes, and I think, you know, I think that the words and the language that we use when talking about sexual deviance, I think, is very important. So talking about preempting listeners' concerns about the use of the word normal or natural and so on is unfortunate in many ways, because if you think about it, you know, those words have no intrinsic moral value in and of themselves. To say that something is not normal just simply means that the majority of the population does not engage in the behavior, does not experience that type of arousal response. It has nothing to do necessarily with the question of harm, which is what I strove in this book to reorient the conversation to. Looking at this question of what is harmful and clearly identifying the parameters of sexual harm and understanding that in a more significant way than I think that we use that term in contemporary society. We use it so flippantly, I think, to refer to anything that would harm us but wouldn't necessarily harm other people. To me, that's the conversation that we should be moving more toward, you know, leaving these questions, these philosophically vacuous questions of what's natural and what's normal, and moving toward this question of what's harmful. Normal is just a number. What's natural similarly has no useful philosophical value in a semantic sense, because that would assume that there was a god, basically, that designed human reproductive anatomy to be used for some specific purpose, and anything outside that natural range would be somehow immoral. You know, and we already talked about the fact that we're both atheists, and to assume that, you know, the question of what's natural is a good guidepost, moral guidepost, to deciding what is okay or what's not okay in the sexual domain, I think is as flawed as relying on the question of what's normal.
I want to reiterate this, the idea of harm then, because this is the message that's all the way through the book. It's the main theme of it, I think, this idea that the key determinant here, the key important thing, the important aspect is whether or not something is harmful either to another person or indeed to yourself.
Right, or an animal.
Or an animal, or a rock, or some gravel.
Absolutely, and I don't want to give the impression that, you know, identifying the parameters of harm is necessarily easier than those questions of what's normal and what's natural. And when it comes,
no, I mean, it gets very complicated.
Very complicated.
We'll see when we get into the third part of the show.
Very complicated, but I do think that we haven't been spending enough time on that concept of harm. I think that it's not easy to, you know, to talk deeply and meaningfully and maybe make changes on the basis of this harm principle. But I think that that is what we should be doing. I think that we should be concentrating our intellectual efforts, our legal efforts, our philosophical efforts in the domain of deviance when it comes to this issue of harm, and at least making an effort to elaborate on this concept.
I'm Charlotte Higgins, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I want to move us into the next part, really, I want to spend the second part of the show looking at paraphilia as the distinction of an unusual sexual attraction to something. And we'll get more into that in the second half. But before we do, I want to talk about what the distinction is between that idea and a sexual orientation, say. So towards the end of the book, you use this analogy, which I'll ask you to repeat now, although we'll discuss the last part of it later in the show. You use this analogy of like a slot machine. So tell us that story, and we'll sort of go through it as you do at the different levels.
Sure. And before I give you this example, I should say that when I use that word orientation, I use it not in the traditional sense of gay, bisexual, homosexual. That's the traditional use of the word orientation. But I use it more in the sense to capture any sexual arousal response pattern that is recurrent, what the brain, or basically what the genitals, orient to in terms of an orientation response. And the key here is that the person has zero control. Has not decided to have that particular response profile. That's simply how their physiology orients or responds. So I think although that word orientation has loads of sociopolitical implications, you know, in the common vernacular, when you use the word orientation, people get quite upset when it's used to describe pedophiles, for instance, or zoophiles, people who are attracted to animals or whatever, because, you know, they think it's some sort of slippery road. But that's completely separate, I think, from the scientific use of the word orientation, because from a scientific perspective, it's simply, again, what your brain or what your genitals orient to. And it basically sort of implies that there's no deliberate or conscious will involved in the matter. This is simply who you are with your singular erotic profile. So the example that I gave in the book that you mentioned draws from the analogy of a Las Vegas slot machine. When, you know, if you were to go into a casino and you came across this special slot machine, and there were four windows behind the glass, and the overall sort of configuration of those four symbols, however they happen to line up, is going to be the composite portrait of your orientation or your sexual arousal response. You can envision it basically breaking down this way. The first window would be, you know, whether you're attracted to the same sex, to the opposite sex, to both sexes, or even neither sex. You could be an asexual, for instance. So this would simply be the gender of the other that you would be attracted to. The second window would represent your primary, what I call the erotic target. And the erotic target would be, in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, of course, it would be another human being. You're going to be most aroused by another human being. But there are some cases where people are actually more attracted to other species, for instance. Again, these are the zoophiles. Or maybe you're more attracted to an inanimate object. You could be an objectophile, or it's also called an objectum sexual. Or again, maybe you're an asexual and you're not attracted to anything on the face of the earth. The next window would be your primary sexual behavior, what attracts you most or what arouses you the most when it comes to the actual act of obtaining an orgasm, basically. So this could be, you know, traditional sex with a consenting partner. This could be some type of behavior-oriented sexual paraphilia. So maybe you're an exhibitionist, or you're a sadist, or you're a voyeur, or you're a frotterist, which means that you get most of your sexual gratification from touching other people in public places, and so on. Or maybe it's just simply masturbation, or again, maybe you have no sexual activity at all. And finally, in that fourth window would be the erotic age orientation, which would be the primary biological age that you are attracted to in another partner, whether, again, that's a human being or something else. And surprisingly, it's not just simply being a pedophile or being a normal person. There are actually several shades of erotic age orientation. And again, it's how all of these symbols would line up in that slot machine that would determine your unique identity as a sexual human being today. And again, you know, you had no control over it. There's a very complex algorithm here involving genetics, involving prenatal experiences, involving early childhood events, diet, stress, anxiety, all these types of, all these inscrutable elements that are interacting in some way to determine the ultimate outcome on your particular slot machine spin.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. This week I'm talking to Jesse Baring, and we're talking about his book Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us. So in this part then, Jesse, I want to have a closer look at some paraphilias. To start us off on this, I'd like you to tell us a story from the book, which is of a historical example, which was one of my favourite bits in the book, something I'd never heard of before, which is the Pigmen of New Haven.
So one of the more interesting sort of historical examples that I found of, I guess, what could be considered or conceptualized as a moral panic, a sexual panic, involved the colony of New Haven, which is today in the state of Connecticut, and it's actually quite close to the Yale campus. But back in the 1600s and early 1700s, there was a concern that the men in the society were somehow colluding with the devil to have sex with barnyard animals and create these hybrid species, half evil and half human and saintly. And there were several incidents in which these piglets were born to some sows at a local farm. And the piglets had some distinctive characteristic, like a milky white eye or something. And that eye, in some cases, happened to resemble the glaucoma or some sort of ocular deficit in one of the local male residents in the community. And the assumption was that the man had had sex with the sow, and the sow got pregnant, and, you know, now we've got these half humans and half devil piglets sort of running around. They called these animals, these half human animals, prodigies, which has a very different meaning than it does today. Of course, when you hear the word prodigy, you think of a genius or something, but back then it meant half devil. This was an idea that was kind of fanned by biblical scripture. Thomas Aquinas was the person who, you know, got people very concerned about people having sex with animals and engaging in bestiality and bringing the devil to earth, basically. But anyway, those men that were unfortunately accused of getting these sows pregnant were oftentimes put on trial and burned at the stake because people were absolutely convinced that this was biologically possible. Of course, you know, they probably didn't have sex with the sows. You know, it's possible, maybe, that they were engaging in bestiality, but it's unlikely. It was probably just this sort of, again, moral panic that was occupying the territory at that point.
And also, the interesting thing at this point is we're still at that time where both the man and the sow are equally culpable in this crime.
Right. So the sow would actually be held on trial as well. And the sow would be executed just like the human being. There was a point in time, actually, in the early 1800s, I believe, when people actually began to sort of question this, and they saw the animals as being the victims and being raped. And there was a famous case in France where a donkey was raped by a man. And many of the local townspeople testified about her virtues and about how she'd been such a pure specimen and hadn't engaged in any sort of behavior like this in the past. And they saved her life because the human being was actually executed for raping the donkey, but they spared the donkey's life.
So what we're talking about here is zoophilia, which is it's obviously a recognized condition.
Well, those cases, you know, these historical cases, it's questionable whether they were actually zoophiles, certifiable zoophiles. I think that they probably got railroaded into some, you know, it was a very unfortunate period of time in terms of the circumstances that they found themselves in, and they probably didn't have sex with the animals, or they did have sex with them, but they just were using the animals as surrogates for human beings. We do know today, and actually just within the past 15 years or so, that there really are people that are more aroused by other animals, other species, than they are human beings. So it's not that they simply have sex with a goat or a sheep on a farm because they can't get a human partner, so they're using it as a surrogate. They actually get more aroused by the animal than they do the person.
But this is then a good case of one of those paraphilias where it's very difficult to determine harm, isn't it? Obviously, an animal can't consent, but at the same time, are we really doing it any harm?
Right. And it's, you know, this was a, you know, there are lots of parts of the book that were very difficult for me to write. And this was one of them because I happen to be a very platonic animal lover. So thinking about having sex with animals is not pleasant to me. But if you look at the individual cases clearly and closely, the harm that occurs to the animal at the center of the investigation is not always completely clear. So, for instance, many zoophiles are actually on the receiving end of the sexual encounter. They're the bottoms, let's put it that way, with a horse, for instance. And they actually experience much more significant physical damage or the risk of internal injuries than the horse in that scenario. But if you also think about many of the things that we do to animals in terms of causing harm that don't raise eyebrows and eating them, slaughtering them, basically. One of the examples I give in the book, for instance, is let's say you've got two people. One is the manager of a horse farm, and he has a stud stallion, and he understands that the seed of that stallion is worth a lot of money. And the only way to get that seed is to electro-ejaculate the horse, which actually requires quite a painful procedure of inserting an electrical rod into its rectum and stimulating its prostate to obtain its semen, which again is all evidence suggests that it's quite a harmful exercise. That's perfectly legal. And, you know, we don't really see many people complaining about those types of behaviors. But if you compare what he's done to, say, a woman that owns an old horse on a farm or something, and she's gently masturbating that horse to sexual gratification because she gets sexual pleasure from it. And all indications, at least behaviorally, is that the horse enjoys it too. And she's very sensitive to whether it's experiencing any sort of discomfort. We tend to demonize what she's done as being disgusting and evil and wrong. And, we don't bat an eyelash when it comes to what the other guy's done in terms of stimulating his horse for profit. I think that's quite telling. Actually, you know, it's the same end product, an orgasm in another species, but the way that we get there, one is harmful and the other's not. But the one that's not harmful involves sex, and that's the one that we have a problem with. If we move this conversation toward this issue of harmfulness, and we look at individual cases, we don't try to paint them all with some broad brush, but we look closely at individual cases, and we are burdened with the task of defining in operational terms some demonstrable harm. You know, sometimes it's not as easy as it would appear at first glance.
I want to have another look at the idea of paraphilia through the lens of history, really. And this is the categorization of what we would now call hypersexual people. Everybody will be familiar with the term nymphomaniac. We'll talk about where that comes from in a moment. But not many people will necessarily be familiar with the term satyriasis. So what does that mean?
Right. So a satyr or satyriasis was basically a hypersexual male. So it was the male counterpart to nymphomania back in the late 19th century when sexologists were sort of investigating or trying to unravel this construct of having too much sexual desire and defining the limits of normal arousal patterns. And There were, throughout history, a couple of cases of males, of men being diagnosed with hypersexuality or satyriasis that actually ended up leading to their exoneration for different sexual offenses. For instance, some men that were accused of even fairly heinous crimes of rape or sexual coercion, when the consulting psychiatrist came to the court and testified on behalf of their condition of satyriasis that they couldn't help it. It was some type of neurological condition that they were so hyper-aroused or arousable. They were actually given lighter sentences or let off completely. But historically, sex researchers, and I think, you know, most of the public, have been much more focused on female sexuality as being deviant, you know, women's hypersexuality, this this idea that somehow they're nymphomaniacs, that, you know, that's what really took hold of the public consciousness for a long time. Men who were sexual, for the most part, were just kind of viewed as criminals or as, you know, not being like every other male, but just not being able to get a handle on their own desires or their arousal patterns. Women, by contrast, that had too much sex were viewed as sick or ill.
You mentioned there the idea of sex researchers, and although both of these terms, nymphomaniac and satyriasis, that, you know, they're archaic, nymphomaniac itself never really actually meant anything. It's just a term of abuse that comes from history. But it is interesting that this is the point where these things come out of the point where people are actually starting to research sex as an academic field.
Yes, and I should point out, actually, that those terms, nymphomania and satyriasis, are still included in the International Classification of Diseases by the WHO, the World Health Organization, which is the diagnostic manual that's in place in much of the world outside of North America and the UK. So they actually aren't quite as archaic as you might think. They're still used very infrequently, but they're still on the books in many parts of the world.
I'm Eric Schlosser, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
People who have listened to Little Atoms for a while and will be familiar with DSM-5 categories of psychological disorders, if disorders is the right word. Again, it's a contentious word. So let's talk about the way that sexuality and paraphilias have been categorized in that sort of way.
Right. So historically, it's been quite contentious in the sense of what should be diagnosable as a genuine mental disorder or psychiatric illness and included in the DSM-5. You know, for a long time, of course, homosexuality was in there. It wasn't removed until 1973. And actually, up until the 1980s, there was a subcategory of homosexuality, which was called egodystonic homosexuality, which was in place even after the formal definition of homosexuality was removed. And egodystonic homosexuality basically characterized people who were gay, but they really, really didn't want to be gay. They didn't really sort of identify with the as a homosexual, and this caused a lot of personal distress for them. And that's been removed now. But these days, the only paraphilias or sexual conditions that are included in the DSM are those that the psychiatric community views as causing significant distress, either distress to the individual, him or herself, or to the erotic target, whatever the primary source of arousal happens to be. So, for example, voyeurism is in there, sadism is in there, pedophilia is in there, exhibitionism is in there. There are some that are more contentious than others that are in there. There's transvestic fetishism, for instance, that's still included in the DSM-5. You know, these are men primarily who derive some sort of sexual satisfaction from wearing female garments. That is still included in the DSM-5, but the catch is that they have to themselves be experiencing personal distress to be diagnosed with the psychiatric disorder. If they're okay with it, you know, they're perfectly fine with the fact that they like to wear bras or panties or under their suits or whatever, and that gets them off, then they're not seen as having a mental disorder. It's all about whether they experience some personal distress. But even that gets complicated because personal distress itself is a reflection of society's attitudes toward these particular orientations or these particular arousal response patterns. Obviously, if society thinks that you're a pervert or thinks you're sick or thinks you're disgusting because of what you're sexually attracted to, that's going to be a breeding ground for personal distress.
But although there are only, I think it was 7, wasn't it, that were actually still named in the DSM, paraphilias, there are obviously countless identified paraphilias, and some of them, I mean, some of the, you only really use this one as an illustrative example, but like some that struck me as, there was one where you suggested that a person who might get turned on by masturbating in fog while listening to somebody stuttering was a thing that seemed to be like something that might have happened on one occasion and would be pretty amazing if the same thing occurred to the same person, never mind a number of people at different places around the world.
Right. So a couple of things to point out, I guess. So first of all, you know, I'm not sure if we ever identified or defined paraphilia. And paraphilia is basically just love outside of the norm. That's how it's literally transcribed. So it's a Greek term. Some have suggested that paralognia is actually a better term because paralognia is literally translated as lust outside of the norm. And what we're talking about here has nothing to do with love, really. It's nothing to do with romance or anything like that. It's just about what turns us on the most. So it really is about lust. And again, in the DSM, five, there are just a handful of the more common paraphilias, like we just went over. But as you said, there have been identified hundreds of paraphilias, discrete paraphilias. Some of them are incredibly rare. You know, they might apply to one or two people on the face of the earth that have ever lived, such as somebody who likes to masturbate in the foggy mist or something like that. But nevertheless, there are documented cases of individuals having these very unusual response patterns. So climacophilia, you know, you can only have an orgasm while you're tumbling down the stairs, for instance, or apotemnophilia. Many people with apotemnophilia, not all of them, but many people with apotemnophilia actually can only get an orgasm at the thought of themselves as amputees. People who are formicophiles require having insects on their genital regions as they're masturbating in order to get sexual satisfaction. Melissophiles need a bee or a wasp or something like that somewhere in the environment buzzing around to get sexual satisfaction. So they run the spectrum. And the vast majority of them are actually quite innocuous. They're harmless. They're rare. They're interesting. They're incredibly unusual. But they're not things that we really need to be worried about in terms of the harm that they would cause to either the individual who engages in them or other people.
These things are much more likely, significantly more likely to affect men than women.
Yes, paraphilias are dramatically more common in human males, at least, than women. And I think the ratio breaks down, according to the most recent estimates in the clinical literature, at 99 to 1. 99 male paraphiliacs to 1 female paraphiliac.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of get to the point of why they happen, when they get fixed in the imagination, and why there's a difference between male and female.
So I'm all for gender equality, I should say. But nevertheless, there does seem to be a dramatic sex difference when it comes to sexual deviance. Men seem to be much more likely to be sexually imprinted early in development, sort of stamped with an irrevocable pattern of attraction on the basis of something that they were exposed to between a fairly narrow age range of around 4 to 9, which is actually quite early, I think most people would assume. It's not a fixed window of time, but that's the sort of sensitive period, 4 to 9. There are probably a couple of years on either end of that spectrum where boys are still susceptible to being sexually imprinted. But something happens in their early development like that, that they just happen to be aroused and they experience something quasi-sexual that puts them on this track to fetishism or paraphilia as adults. And we don't know that for certain, but we know that on the basis of adult males that have these sexually deviant characteristics that reflect back about where they think it came from or the origins of their own paraphilia or fetish or kink. And the vast majority of them can give you a very discrete moment in their autobiography that happens to coincide side with that age range or a series of events that occurred early in their childhood. So one of the most common types of paraphilias, for instance, is called podophilia, more traditionally known as foot fetishism. If you ask men who are, and I think feet are absolutely loathsome, you know, my feet are disgusting. I think other people's feet are rather hideous as well. So it's hard for me to understand the mind of a podophile. But nevertheless, I understand that they're out there and there's many of them, and I wish them all the best with their sexual orientation, and there's nothing wrong with it. I think it's absolutely harmless. Anyway, if you ask them where it came from, many of them can give you quite specific details about, for instance, being encouraged by their mother to massage her feet while she was moaning in pleasure when they were a kid, or, you know, wrestling with their older brother, their older brother's friends or something when they were little, and the feet flying in their face, or taking off their father's shoes after a hard day's work and the father acting, you know, very pleased that they were rubbing their feet like that. And, you know, the boy just happened to have an erection or something while this was happening. They can give you these very specific examples of where their podophilia came from, where the sort of first cause of their podophilia. That's how we know, at least at the moment, the etiology or the origins of the paraphilias or the fetishes. The trick or the frustration that many sexologists face when studying the origins of the paraphilias is the fact that it's extremely difficult to do good controlled laboratory research on this topic, because you can't obviously take a group of healthy newborn infants and assign one to a control condition, one group to a control condition and the other group to the experimental condition, where you systematically manipulate certain experiences that they have as they're growing up with their sexuality and twiddle your thumbs for 16 or 18 years and see who grows up to be sexually deviant. From an empirical perspective, it is a question that could be answered, but probably for good reason we can't do it ethically. So all we have really are openly adult paraphiles, retrospective accounts of when it started, how it started, and some studies involving animal models that we can use possibly as analogs.
Are there any categories of paraphilias that are more common in women than in men?
Not any paraphilia that is more common in women. All of the paraphilias are more common in men, but there are a couple of paraphilias that you're more likely to find women than other paraphilias. The best example is the BDSM community or sadomasochism, whereas for most of the paraphilias, it's 99 to 1. For sadomasochism, it's more like 20 to 1. So again, you still find more men in the S&M community, but you're more likely to find women there than you would in other paraphilic categories. But even in the S&M category, women are much more likely to be the masochists in the relationship, to derive pleasure from pain or being the submissive partner, than they are the sadistic or dominant partner, which lines up pretty nicely, actually, with, you know, some of the contemporary cultural trends with books like 50 Shades of Grey.
I was thinking in particular here of Mrs. Eiffel, the woman who married the Eiffel Tower and the woman who fell in love with the Berlin Wall.
So one of the other categories where you're probably going to be more likely to find women represented in the sexual paraphilias is the objectophiles or the objectum sexuals. And these are individuals that basically have sexual and romantic relationships with inanimate objects because they are under the impression that the objects have some type of, have a personality, basically, have psychological attributes, including feelings of sexual desire. And those feelings actually extend to them as romantic partners. So the most famous case is that of Erika Eiffel, and her last name becomes clear. The reason that she has that last name becomes clear when you know that she married the Eiffel Tower, I think about a decade ago. I'm not sure what the current status of the relationship is, but she viewed the Eiffel Tower as having a very complex personality and having sexual feelings, including sexual feelings for her. And what made it even more interesting or more complicated, I suppose, is the fact that she viewed the Eiffel Tower as actually being female. So she would be, I suppose, a bisexual objectophile, because she'd had other relationships in the past. She was also in a romance with the Golden Gate Bridge before this, and that was a male in her mind. So she would be considered a bisexual. So yes, women are going to be, you're going to find women in that objectophile category because they seem to, people that have objectophilia tend to be on the autistic spectrum. And in particular, they happen to have a symptom of autism called object personification synesthesia, where they confuse the categories of animate and inanimate, and they see psychology or psychological traits in inanimate objects. They see basically the world as being pantheistic, but this is more of a sexual domain and not a religious one. So the objectophiles are very rare, and they're very interesting, and they're very different, actually, from the more common object fetishists, who happen to be mostly men. So your traditional or stereotypical object fetishist would be somebody like the panty fetishist, for instance. You know, this type of person needs a pair of panties, used panties in particular, to derive any sexual satisfaction. And the pair of panties have actually taken on more of a sexual element or more attractive or more arousing to him than the actual person that the panties were worn by. And the key with object fetishism, like somebody who's into, and you know, panty fetishism is just one of them. There have been fetishists of wheelchairs or crutches or swim caps or rubber gloves or hearing aids, you name it. But the key with an object fetishist is that they are aroused by the fact that the object has made physical contact with the source of their true attraction. It somehow has made physical contact with the body of the person that they find sexually appealing. So a shoe fetishist, for instance, isn't going to go to the local shoe store and buy a brand new pair of never worn sneakers and masturbate to those. He's going to go to, you know, some used shoe store or steal a pair of shoes and masturbate to the idea that those shoes were actually worn by somebody that he finds attractive.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. This week I'm talking to Jesse Baring, and we're talking about his book Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us. And moving into the third part of the show then, Jesse, I want to look at another one of those paraphilias from the DSM-5 that's most definitely categorised as harmful. I don't think there's any sort of aspect of deviant sexuality, both in its practice and in the sort of moral panic around it, that arouses more fear and anger, especially in the UK, than paedophilia. What I was interested to discover from this book was paedophilia itself is, I mean, we think of it in that tabloid way. A paedophile is somebody who has sex with children or is attracted to children. But there's many more distinctions than that. And you've mentioned already this idea of the erotic age orientation. So let's talk about those categories first of all.
Sure. And, you know, this was again, like writing about animals and sex, this was again a topic that was very difficult for me to write and to go into. It's not pleasant, of course. But I also think that this is the sexual issue of our age. This is the moral issue of our age. So it would be absolutely foolish or naive or a missed opportunity not to at least get people on the same page in terms of the science when it comes to pedophilia and to understand what that word means and what it doesn't mean. So the chapter that I go into this topic, you know, I explore what you call the erotic age orientations. And there are actually several shades of erotic age orientations I learned in writing this. It's not just simply, you know, being a pedophile and attracted to children or being attracted to adults. There are actually different levels, I suppose, or biologically based maturation patterns that are associated with your strongest arousal response. So the true pedophile is somebody who is attracted to a prepubescent child. So I'm not sure actually what the age of menarche is in the UK, for instance, but in most of the world, it's about 12 or 13 now, I think, for girls at least. So if you're a heterosexual pedophile, then you'd be attracted to a child that's under that age. But then there's this fairly new classification of what's called a hebephile. And a hebephile is somebody who is attracted to a pubescent aged adolescent. So a child that's basically sort of on the cusp of adolescence. And this is probably best characterized by the most famous case of all, which is Lolita in Nabokov's novel, famous novel by the same name. And people who are attracted to pubescence, again, the chronological age isn't as important as the biological age or the physical characteristics that go along with physical maturation. But it's probably between the ages of maybe 11 to 14, something along those lines. And a phoebophile, moving further up that age spectrum, is somebody who's attracted to older adolescents. So 15 to 18, I suppose, something in that range. A teleophile is somebody who is most attracted to reproductive-aged adults. So in principle, at least, this would be the majority of society, although we actually don't know that for certain, which is another interesting question that I'll go back to in just a moment. And then finally, we've got the gerontophile category, and the gerontophiles are attracted primarily to the elderly or those displaying some physical characteristics of extreme age, physical maturation.
So the ephebophile, which is the third category there were basically three categories which in the UK and I think in the States would be considered basically illegal paedophiles, but three different classifications. But the ephebophile is somebody who, depending on where they happen to travel to around the world, would find themselves in different legal situations. So there's this interesting idea that all around the world we have different age of consent laws.
Yeah, and even in the same, you know, even in the same relative geographical region, we've got major differences as well. In the US, ages of consent range from 15 to 18.
I was stunned to discover that it's 15 in Colorado as well. That's an amazing fact.
And interestingly, historically, you know, there was even a period of time where 21 was the ideal age of consent. At least that was the age that many in the human rights movement at that time, the feminists especially, were especially important in the age of consent laws, tried to move the age of consent up to 21. Ultimately, they conceded and it was moved to 18 from 16 in most states, U.S. states. But they thought that 21 made sense because that was the age that women could inherit property. So, you know, if women couldn't inherit property until they were 21, they shouldn't be able to consent to having sex until they were that age as well. But there's nothing, you know, there is a bit of arbitrariness, I suppose, when it comes to age of consent. There's nothing sort of magical that happens at the age of 18, obviously, or 16, or 21, or whatever it happens to be, that is a universal characteristic of human psychological development. So it kind of is a gist sense of what is about right or seems about right for the given community that you happen to be dealing with.
There's an interesting, I mean, there's lots of ways in which that, you know, that can seem ludicrous, the huge range across from about 11 to 21 all around the world. You mentioned an interesting case in the UK, though, an interesting idea that the age of consent in the UK is 16. So a couple of 16-year-olds could have a relationship, or, you know, a 19-year-old man could have a relationship with a 16-year-old girl, and that would be perfectly legal and above the board, and they could do what they like. But if he took photographs of her while they were doing it, that would be illegal, because photographs of people under 18 are considered child porn.
Right. So there's all sorts of uncomfortable tensions, I think, in the legal system when it comes to ages of consent. And I think technology is forcing us to address those and consider them maybe a bit more deeply. And that's one example. If you've got a given age of consent that is beneath the age of 18 in some part of the world, it's perfectly fine for you to have sex with that person as many times as you want, consensual sex in the privacy of your own home. But if you happen to take a single nude picture of that person and somehow somebody finds that, you know, in your possession, then you would be potentially vulnerable to federal prosecution for violating child pornography laws. So if you ask yourself, you know, what is more potentially harmful, the sexual relationship or taking a consensual picture of that person, you know, it's not entirely clear why there would be that division. These are not easy problems to solve, certainly. I'm not trying to suggest that they are. But when you get into the details of individual cases, it becomes incredibly complex. You know, when you kind of lean in very closely and look at the details of individual cases that are not quite as straightforward as outright child abuse. I mean, clearly, it's, in my view, it's completely different when we're talking about a 6-year-old, for instance, than a 16-year-old. I view a 6 and 16-year-old as fundamentally, qualitatively distinct types of organisms when it comes to sexuality. So treating the 16-year-old as though he or she were a 6-year-old, I think, makes very little sense.
We've discussed the idea that there are three categories of underage sex, basically, your ephebophile, your hebephilia, and your paedophile. But it goes even deeper than that, because you describe in the book, and I mean, it's a valid term, but it sounds incredibly flippant when you say it, but the idea of the sort of hands-on and the hands-off paedophile or child abuser, let's say, because they're not necessarily paedophiles, which is what I'm getting to. So the idea that you can sexually assault a child or consume child pornography, consume photographs of, let's not call it child porn because I think that's a contentious term, but, you know, photographs of children. And interestingly, you describe that a lot of the people that are seriously sexually abusing children would not actually scientifically be classed as paedophiles.
Yeah, I think, you know, we use the word pedophile. It's a very loaded term, obviously. I can't imagine any term that would be much more negative or, you know, unpleasant to be associated with and being called a pedophile these days. And I think that is its power, you know, the sort of the stigmatization that goes along with being attracted to children. But I think that we use it in a way that is not used. We use it in contemporary society in a way that is not the way that it's used in actual sex research or clinical psychology. We use it basically for anybody that has sex with somebody under the legal age or is attracted to somebody under the legal age. But again, in technical terms, it's just somebody who's attracted to prepubescence, you know, somebody that they're attracted to people that have no secondary sexual characteristics or, you know, genuine children, not adolescents. But one of the more startling things that I found in this research review was that nearly half of all child molesters, those accused of horrendous child sex crimes, are not technically pedophiles, because if you put them in a laboratory and you subject them to some sort of physiological measurement device like a penile plethysmograph, you look at whether they get erections more toward pictures of children or to adults. Half of those that are child molesters actually get more aroused by the adult images. They have used the child basically as a sort of surrogate for an adult partner. you know, for whatever reason, maybe they've got some psychiatric disorder, they've got some executive control problems, they can't inhibit their actions, you know, maybe they were on drugs or they were drinking or something like that. But if you put them under the microscope, they are not technically pedophiles. That's at least half of them, which is actually quite surprising to me. And the term for those people in the clinical world is opportunistic offenders. They would rather have sex with an adult, but for whatever reason, they used whatever was available to them at that time, which unfortunately and sadly, in many cases, was a child. And the difference between them and the true pedophile, of course, is that the true pedophile engages in sexual abuse and molestation because they genuinely find children more attractive or appealing than adults.
I'm Molly Oldfield, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So if we're talking about pedophilia as a paraphilia, as it's defined in the DSM-5 as a condition. And we talked in the second part about when these things, when paraphilias are fixed in people, in, you know, when they're very young, generally men, when they're young, something happens that fixes this sexual obsession in them as well. So I'd like to talk about, I guess, how, well, I'd say as a short left-handed man as well, I'd like to talk a little bit about how paedophiles come to be.
Right. So there have been some correlational studies trying to identify the physical characteristics, both the neurological and the morphological, just sort of the physical traits that go along with pedophilia or being attracted to children primarily. And it's, you know, one of them is being short statured and the other is being left-handed and also low IQ. You don't have low IQ, so I don't think that we have to worry about that. But these, again, are just sort of aggregate trends. Everybody that's left-handed obviously is not pedophilic. And likewise, everybody that are not left-handed and are not short doesn't necessarily mean that they're not pedophilic in their orientation either. So, again, these are just sort of statistical trends, significant trends. But, you know, researchers in this area, and there's much more research in the field of pedophilia than there is other areas of sexual deviance or paraphilias, obviously because of the tremendous importance and the social implications of studying this issue. They're beginning to kind of paint a portrait or develop a composite image of the stereotypical pedophile. And it's not easy to do. And one of the problems, of course, is that the only people that, you know, the only pedophiles that lend themselves to these types of empirical investigations tend to be those that have been ignominiously outed by the authorities. You know, they've been arrested for some crime and they're already in the forensic system. So they're not people that are just kind of signing up to be, you know, the pedophile subject in a random sample. So researchers struggle to find an accurate representation in the general population of those that would fit neatly into these discrete categories of the erotic age orientations. There's some, you know, emerging evidence that there are brain-based differences in pedophiles compared to those who are attracted to adults, but it's not a universal finding.
I just want to finish off then, Jesse, just to summarize, and I want to bring in this idea again about, as I said, the theme of the book all the way through has been this idea of harm, and we tended historically and still obviously today to look at people with any form of sexual deviance through some sort of moral or disapproving lens, whereas you've been asking us all the way through the book to look at people with more compassion, because as we've been describing about paraphilia is the idea that, you know, people are, they're fixed characteristics of people that they simply can't do anything about. So we should have, you know, more compassion and understanding. And when we're talking about somebody who's fallen in love with the Eiffel Tower, that's clearly it's an easy thing to do. And we've just been talking about paedophilia, which clearly is the most critical area, I think, for testing this hypothesis, isn't it? Because paedophiles they're there, they exist. They've either been born that way or have become that way, and there's not a great deal they can do about it. So I guess how should society be going about dealing with them?
Well, I mean, certainly we need to get a grip, I think, and whatever the approaches that we're taking at the moment isn't working because, you know, they're still spilling out of the ether. There are, you know, are these terrible stories all the time about some sort of pedophilic scandal. And I think, you know, I think it's very easy for us really to understand that pedophilia is an orientation, even though it's not technically defined like that by the American Psychological Association or the British Psychological Association. It's still the case that it's impossible for those of us that are not pedophiles, for instance, to all of a sudden decide to be attracted to an 8-year-old, for instance, or if you're a gerontophile, to just simply decide that we're going to be attracted primarily to the elderly. We can't change our erotic age orientation. And I think it's absolutely absurd to think that pedophiles who live a sexual life that none of us wish on our worst enemies have decided to be pedophilic. You know, they have decided to have this incredibly socially stigmatized type of sexual arousal response pattern. And I think once we understand that, we can be in a better position to distinguish between people who engage in immoral or harmful sexual activity toward the most vulnerable members of society, and those that simply have a psychosexual orientation that is beyond their control. I have very little tolerance, I suppose, little patience or little understanding for those who would act on their desires or somehow try to deceive themselves into thinking that acting on the desires toward the most vulnerable members in our society is acceptable, because, you know, that just simply happens to be what arouses them. I think that people in that position, unfortunately, have a much greater burden. They have an onus of responsibility to control themselves because of the harm that would be caused by acting on their sexual desires. And, you know, there are a number of support groups that I learned in writing Curve, actually, for people that are pedophilic, that are sort of, or hebephiles or whatever, that are coming out of the closet and just simply saying that, you know what, this is me. I have no decision over the fact that I'm attracted to minors, and I shouldn't feel ashamed for something I have no control over in terms of my, you know, my biological imprint and who I am as an individual. I should feel ashamed for what I do and if I actually act on those desires. But there are groups like the virtuous pedophiles, for instance, that understand that although they're pedophiles, that it's completely wrong and inappropriate for them to act on their desires. And I think that we should be supportive of groups like that. And we should be having much more open, frank conversations about these types of very uncomfortable, very unpleasant topics if we genuinely want to affect change. And ultimately, if we want to help children, if we want to reduce harm, the more we try to hide these things, push them under the rug and not have these conversations, I think inevitably they're going to lead to unpleasant results.
I want to finish up. I don't want to finish up talking about pedophiles. So I'll ask you that question again more generally then. So say, okay, so I'll out myself on the podcast as a person that can only be sexually aroused in the presence of bees. So how would you like to see society treat me and my fellow bee enthusiasts?
I think that we should look at people like you, Neil, as interesting specimens, really, as completely harmless, fascinating demonstrations of the way that human sexuality can manifest itself in an infinite number of ways and as an ambassador for sexual deviance. Sexual deviance is not inherently bad. It's not a bad term or concept. It simply represents diversity.
That's a perfect place for us to end then. So I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to go off and spend some time with my hive.
Yes, yes. I was wondering why you're a beekeeper in your spare time.
So I've been talking to Jesse Baring, and we've been talking about his book, Perv, The Deviant in All of Us. So Jesse, it's been brilliant talking to you again. Thank you very much for joining Little Atoms again.
It's been great. Thanks for having me, Neil.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So I'm on the phone with the writer Nikki Hodgson, and Nikki, I've asked you to come up with something to talk about, so what we're going to talk about?
We are going to talk about Vladimir Nabokov's novel Lolita.
This is a novel that I guess most people will think they know what it's about, because the titles come to mean something. But what is it about?
What is it about? Well, on the surface, it's about a middle-aged man's obsession with a nymphet, as he calls her, Lolita, prepubescent. Well, she's prepubescent when he meets her and becomes pubescent girl, and his infatuation for her, his relationship with her. But it's about so many more complex things. It's definitely about the nature of desire and how we construct it in our minds. It's about power. It's about capitalism. It's about identity. And it's about censorship. It's come to be about censorship because of the way it was received and how it's been treated ever since. And it has this huge cultural significance. It's really kind of found its way into the cultural psyche in a way that still causes us quite a lot of discomfort around it today. You know, it's a very compelling book because it's so cleverly and beautifully written. But it also touches on this theme of paedophilia, which we have so many problems talking about, conceiving of, and knowing how to deal with in society, even now.
Indeed, and Nabokov wrote this in 1955, so we can imagine the controversy when this book first came out, and normally when we're talking around this subject. So if we were talking about something like Lady Chatterley's Lover, we can talk about the controversy that happened at the time, and now at distance it seems ridiculous because it's not particularly controversial today. But of course, as you've already mentioned, Lolita's an interesting case because the controversy of it still resonates, and indeed, as you said, paedophilia, but also just the sexualization of children is something that seems to concern us particularly at the moment.
Yeah, and this, what's interesting about Lolita is the history of its censorship is that it's been censored by lots of different groups of people from different perspectives over time. So, you know, the first wave was to do with the obscenity of writing about sexuality, you know, so it was considered pornography, and that's why it was obscene. And then the feminists in the 80s started to pick up on it as a book that was about the violence towards women and the commodification of the female body. And now it has a new resonance because we are so paranoid about the sexualization of children, whether we should or should not be justly. So the issues come back round in this perennial way. And I think it's such a taboo subject that it will persist. And the other reason it troubles people is because it's so skillfully written, so that when you are reading it, you understand Humbert, the main character, and you're almost a co-conspirator with him because it's so cleverly written. Something that I've always loved it for is that I studied Renaissance literature at university and focused a lot on the evolution of the love lyric, so from troubadour poetry through to kind of Elizabethan sonneteers. And if you read Lolita, what's so clever about it is that it picks up on all the tropes of romance that we understand from fiction and film and in culture and how we even court each other. And so when you first start to read it, that's how kind of Humbert is wooing not only Lolita, but you, the reader, and you're sort of suckered into that. And then you have this moment of thinking, oh God, no, but he's talking about a child. And that disquiet that it creates in you as a reader is just so clever. And that will never leave the book because of how well it's been constructed.
So when did you first read it?
I read it first when I was 18. And it gripped me. But then I went back to study it when I was doing my degree many years ago now. And I actually studied it as part of a censored literature module. So I studied it alongside things like Salman Rushdie, and Bulgakov and all these other writers that have been censored as well. So we were looking at the history of its censorship and its receptions. It's a really fascinating way to read it, to reread it that way. And, you know, nowadays, so much of my work is around censorship. And I've set up an ethical porn partnership, which is kind of fighting for the rights of consenting adults to make pornography featuring other consenting adults to a certain ethical standard. And so I'm dealing with the same issues day in, day out that are to do with the power of the imagination, you know, the corruptive possibility of media. It's the same things that sort of recur. So the book has a real resonance for me. And my feelings about the book at the time and the kind of thinking I did around why we shouldn't be censorious about it have driven me in the work that I've done since.
So let's widen that out a bit. I want to talk about how this book in particular has been an influence on your work, because of course it's a book that has constantly fought a battle against censorship, but you're talking particularly about, you know, ethical porn partnership, about sexual relations between consenting adults, but of course this is a book about an obsession with a prepubescent girl.
Yes, it is. And the relationship is very much not consensual, although the construction of the character of Lolita suggests that there is some kind of precocity in her, that there's some sort of agency. But the book turns around very quickly at the end of the book, because we see her, she's sort of pregnant, she's down and out, she's got this kind of, she lives in a trailer by the end of it. And you can see that the life has been sucked out of her because of the way that she's been treated. So what you then understand at the end of the novel is that actually, probably earlier on, that was Humbert's sort of deluded perception of how she was receiving his actions. And that in itself is quite interesting and clever too.
Indeed, that's what you talk about, her precocity, but we see that, we're seduced into seeing that through his eyes.
Exactly. But the main point about the book is that art is victimless, you know? So there is no victim because it's fictional. It's interesting. I had a debate about, it was probably a couple of years ago when 50 Shades of Grey came out, with a woman who ran a women's refuge, and she was calling for 50 Shades of Grey to be banned. I don't know if you remember this news story. And we had a debate on the radio about it where she was saying, well, it sanctifies violence against women. It's not consensual. It's blah, blah, blah. And I just made the point, but it's fantasy. So yes, on the surface, if it was an instruction manual, you could consider it immoral, but it's not there to instruct. It's there to delight and entertain. And Lolita's there to do the same. But, you know, Lolita also kind of pushes your moral boundaries and it causes you to question what your values are. So if anybody was in doubt of what they thought about paedophilia, this is the best book to give them as far as I'm concerned, because you certainly won't come out reading it thinking, oh, it's great to abuse children. She, you know, Lolita did okay. That's not what this book does. And that's why we're so afraid of art that confronts moral questions, because actually what we're afraid of is that there might be a part of us, there's something in us that would agree with the kind of problem that we're being presented with, you know. But that's all the more reason to read it and consume it and think about it. That's the brilliant thing about art. It shows, it doesn't tell, and it leaves you to make your mind up.
And I think, yeah, in this case, Nabokov, I think, is such a great case for that, because, and I'm quite on a bit of a lit here, but I think some of the authors of the 20th century that wrote about sexuality, we've already mentioned D.H. Lawrence and Henry Miller and what have you, I think beyond the subject matter that they were writing about and the fact that they were caught up in the controversies, they're a bit crappy.
Yeah.
And Vladimir Nabokov is, I think, unquestionably one of the greatest novelists of the 20th century, if not of all time.
I would say so, yeah. His prose is just, it sticks with you. I mean, I was remembering today one of my favourite phrases about how Humbert describes himself as a great big handsome hunk of movieland manhood. And it's just so effusive. And so it captures that Americana and that kind of bravado. And it's just like such a gorgeous phrase. So many writers wouldn't be able to get away with putting that in and then, you know, keeping the pace and keeping the comedy, because that's the other thing. Lolita is actually quite a funny book. And it's sort of like, how the hell did you write a funny book about paedophilia? But he did. So he's really to be admired.
We're talking about the book. This is also a book that's been transformed into a film by one of the 20th century's greatest ever filmmakers as well, Stanley Kubrick. Am I right in saying that you've not seen that?
I haven't seen the film, no.
So we've been talking about Lolita by Vladimir Nabokov with Nikki Hodgson. So Nikki, you're here to recommend that everybody reads the book, and I need to recommend that you go and see Stanley Kubrick's movie of it, because it is one of the greatest films of the 20th century.
Well, that sounds like a fair trade-off. If that's all I've got to do to make people read this wonderful novel, then so be it.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, or even a lot, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.